A few weeks ago, I was able to do a marriage and single retreat for a fellowship in New York City, a combination of New York City and New Jersey, and they meet in Manhattan downtown. And the retreat was out in the Long Beach Island Shore, a little resort place in New Jersey. And it was fascinating because it was both a married and a singles retreat. You don't think of having those. Usually there are just all marriage retreats where the married couples segregate and have married, or just all single retreats. And I like the idea of marriage and single. In fact, I like the idea of married and singles fellowshipping together. Although I see value in just single people getting together and just married people getting together, I don't see a whole lot of value in it. There is some. I think there's more value when everybody can get together, and I think it's healthy for single people to look at married couples. Because often single people think they'll have no problems once they get married, and they need to see married couples together. And married couples need to fellowship with the single people because they're always thinking, oh, I was so free and happy when I was single. They need to see single people. Because we forget some of those things sometimes. Well, in the Song of Solomon, which is and has been for years for many people a very puzzling book, we see actually human love in the first few chapters before marriage, and in the last four chapters after marriage. People have looked at the Song of Solomon, and I've gotten lots of questions on it as to what it means. And there's various interpretations of it. One, that it is an allegory. There have been some great Bible scholars, both Jewish and Christians, who have looked at this book merely as an extended metaphor, a type. The ancient Jewish scholars, the writers of the Talmud, the Targums, the Mishnah, applied the Song of Solomon to God's love for the people of Israel. Later on, some of the early church fathers and scholars, those who allegorized the scriptures and did not believe in a literal interpretation, like Philo of Alexandria, Clement, Origen, Augustine, saw in the Song of Solomon nothing more than an allegory of the love of Christ for his church and vice versa. Now, there are some beautiful analogies, but some of these people drew the metaphor too far. When we get to the portion where the Shulamite says, I am dark but lovely, the early church fathers said that is a picture of the church ugly in sin, needing salvation, but lovely after she gets saved. Now, that's beautiful typology, but you just don't find that in the book. That is, the book itself gives you no precedent to interpret it that way. If you want to do it on your own and get into it, that's fine, but that is not the principal theme of the book. The principal theme of the book is very simple. Although the Bible speaks about the bride of Christ, the church, although the Bible speaks of the fact that Israel is the wife of Jehovah, the Song of Solomon is extolling human love in marriage. It's simply God extolling human love. Now, a lot of people scratch their head at that and say, why would God do that? Well, why wouldn't God do that? He invented marriage. He invented sensuality and sexuality to be culminated in marriage. And today, since there is so much perversion of that act, it's wonderful to know that there is an entire book of the Bible devoted to how sexuality fits in marriage and intimacy, the longing in courtship to be with one another, the culmination on the wedding day, and the marriage maturing. And the first four chapters is a whole section on dating and courtship. And the last four chapters speak of a marriage after the honeymoon that goes through its adjustments and goes on to maturity. It's a beautiful depiction of God extolling human love. There was a survey done several years ago, actually not too many years ago, and people were asked as to their opinion of the future of family and marriage in the United States. 71%, almost three-fourths, said they believe that family life is in trouble in the United States and failing. 71%. Now, I think if you were to poll people today, you'd get a lot more saying that. In an entirely different survey, couples were asked personal questions. Not what do you think of America, but what about your personal marriage, your love relationship with your spouse? 75%, three quarters, believed, they said, that their own family life was in disrepair at home, and they believed that their marriage was a failure. Three quarters. Then in another survey, where they polled just young people between the ages of 20 and 35. By the way, how many people between the ages of 20 and 35 married do we have here tonight? Raise your hands, please. That's a good amount. Of those polled, six couples out of 100 said that they had happy marriages. Six out of 100. Now, after hearing those two statistics, if you go back up and say, what is the future of family life in America? I think more than 71% would say that it is failing. Song of Solomon, as we said, pictures human love. God in the midst of a husband and wife. They love one another deeply. The first four chapters, as we said, is before their marriage, and they can't wait to get married. As it is with most people who are engaged. They just can't wait. And yet there's this beauty in waiting before any real intimacy sexually is concerned. Now this morning we talked about David and his unbridled lust. We saw the negative side. Tonight we see the positive side. And it's important that we recognize a few basics. First of all, God invented marriage. It's His institution. Before government, before the church, God instituted the family. Before anything else, the family unit was number one. The first institution was marriage. He invented it. It's not man's idea. It doesn't say in the course of human history, man decided he needed a tax break and so he invented marriage. God created man and woman, male and female. And God said it is not good that man should be alone. Because God invented marriage, man neither has the right nor the ability to tamper with it. It's a God-given institution. If man invented it, he would then have the right to regulate it, to tamper with it, to throw it out if he wanted to. But because God invented it, man neither has the capability nor the right to touch it. And Jesus said that. What God has joined together, let not man separate. Once you're together, you're together. And so we read that beautiful act in the book of Genesis, where God, after he made his creation, and he remarked on his creation, and after he made different things, he said, that's good. He'd made the heavens and the earth. He said, it's good. He made the sea. That's good. He made the stars. It's good. He kept saying it's good till he got to man. He looked at man. He said, it is not good that man should be alone. He made man upon the earth, made him head of the creation. And although Adam had the best job of anybody ever, he had what people retire for. The best job. He named animals all day long. In a beautiful green Garden of Eden, smog-free, tax-free, hassle-free environment. You think, oh, you've got it all. But it wasn't enough. Because he was alone. Now, there are exceptions to that. But the rule is, it's not good that man should be alone. Now, there are exceptions. Some people can serve the Lord as a single man or a single woman all of their life and be very contented. Paul the Apostle even said, I wish that you would be like I am, single, and just serve the Lord wholeheartedly. You wouldn't have the distractions of having to provide for anybody. You could just focus totally on the Lord. But he also recognized that it's the exception and not the rule. That for most people, it is not good that man should be alone. And for me, believe me, it was not good that I should be alone. God knew what I needed. God gave me a wonderful bride to fulfill me. So God said that he created all of the birds and all of the beasts of the field. Basically, this is what I say at weddings. I'm kind of going through a wedding here. And he brought them to Adam to see what he would name them. And whatever Adam named them became its name. Yet among all of God's creation, all of the animals, there still wasn't found man's best friend. Ever heard? The dog is man's best friend. Well, God didn't agree with that. Because after all of the animals were created, he said, he's still not complete. Among all of them was not found a completion. And that's what it was, a completion. God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper comparable to him. Now, that doesn't sound too impressive, does it? People read that and they, especially the gals, they think, I will make a helper for him? Is that all I am, a helper? As if he's going to stand up and say, I take you to be my lawfully wedded cook and my dishwasher till death do us part? That's easy. I want more than that. So does God. The word means a completion or a fulfillment. It's the same word that is used when it says God is a very present help in time of trouble. Same word used. In fact, in other places in the Old Testament, it's translated rescue. It's not good that man should be alone. I'll rescue him from his aloneness. And so every courtship, every marriage of two Christians who are devoted to the Lord is God's rescue operation. Designed to rescue them from the state of being alone to be fulfilled one for another. And that is extolled in the book of the Song of Solomon like no other book in the Bible. I love it. So I was reading through it the last couple weeks. It didn't seem hazy and foggy to me. It seemed very forthright, clear-cut, and wonderful. It showed the struggles between a young couple dating, wanting to be close physically, but restraining themselves until marriage, yet being very vocal about how they feel, having problems in the relationship, all the way through to the wedding ceremony, where Solomon rides on his horse and she describes him as this gallant knight in shining armor, coming to whisk her away on his horse, and they take the procession off to his house from Lebanon all the way to Jerusalem with 600 of his valiant men. They have a wedding feast. They have the honeymoon, and that's described in here as well. God isn't ashamed of it. You know, it says in the Old Testament, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave unto his wife, for the two shall become one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. I notice that at most wedding ceremonies, that verse is sort of kept out, because people go, they kind of blush at that for some reason. And so just the first portion is read and that whole context is left out. But it says the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed of it. There was nothing to be ashamed of until the next chapter when sin enters their relationship. And then they thought, we're naked. We got to cover ourselves up. And God said, who told you you were naked? You see, shame entered when sin entered. But there was no shame. And here's a beautiful love relationship where there really is no shame in it at all. By the way, do you remember your wedding day, couples? Can you look back and you remember it? Maybe some of you it's a little hazy. Remember how you felt? I did a wedding yesterday. And I love weddings because I have the best seat in the house. I'm about 8 inches away from the couple. And this couple really impressed me. And usually, as she comes down the aisle, everybody's looking at her, but I always look at the groom. I want to see his reaction, his body language. And usually, you know, many, sometimes it's just stunning. It's just because he realizes, I'm getting married. I had one guy faint on me twice in a wedding, looking at her coming down the aisle. We finally sat him in a chair and finished the ceremony. But yesterday, as she was coming down the aisle, I turned and looked at Gary. And he just kind of, his countenance dropped. And he turns to me and said, she's pretty. I hope he always remembers that. Hope he always remembers, oh, what a beautiful woman. And I hope he always has that love in his heart. I hope you have that love in your heart. And if you have a tape of your wedding, video or audio, play it on your anniversary once a year. Play it more if you'd like. Memorize it if you'd like. People say, what do you listen to in your car? My wedding.
Your what?
Oh, yeah, it was great. I believe God wants every Christian married couple to be an example to a dark world of how He intended it to work. So they go, my, what a difference. My, how He loves her. My, how she loves Him. And so it says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And you might remember that Solomon wrote 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. Prolific writer. And of all of the over 1,000 songs, he calls this the Song of Songs. This is the best one I got. That was his love song. A good old-fashioned love song put here in the Bible. The Song of Songs, the best, the cream of the crop, which is Solomon's. Now, some of you might be asking a very pertinent question, a very good question if you're thinking about it. Why would God use Solomon, of all people, to extol marriage when he had 700 wives and 300 concubines? And the faithfulness of marriage, you go, wait a minute. God, you got to get somebody else for the job. I mean, was everybody on strike that day? The answer to that is that this is probably written for Solomon's first wife. It seems that it was written early in his reign, immediately after his first marriage, before his heart turned away to idolatry. You see, even a person madly in love with his wife can go astray. And it was with Solomon that he turned actually from the Lord and had 1,000 gals in his palace. Whew. Too radical. It says, and this is the Shulamite speaking, the Shulamite girl, two principal actors, Solomon and the woman. There are others involved, but it says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine because of the fragrance of your good ointments. Your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore the virgins love you. Lead me away, or take me away. We will run after you. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. The first four verses, actually the first four chapters, have a lot dealing with the longing that this young couple has for each other and to be with each other. And you notice that when a young couple is dating and madly in love with each other, and they're engaged, that they just can't spend enough time with each other. There's a longing, and there is a longing to be intimate with each other, to be together. And what's beautiful about this is, although the longing is expressed in this book, there is restraint when it comes to sexuality. It's beautiful how there is restraint before the marriage. After the wedding ceremony is all over with, there is no restraint at all. They go for it. But it's after the consummation of the marriage ceremony. Beautiful restraint. You know, more relationships have been torn down by a thing called love, which is really not love. It's really, in reality, either infatuation or lust. But, you know, no one likes to admit that. They're all convinced that it's true love. You could say, you know what, man? You're in lust. I am not. Then how come you're sleeping together? Because we love each other. Well, the Bible says love is patient. It will wait. If you can't wait, you don't have love. Infatuation is called love. And many people are very immature when it comes to this. They're convinced that their infatuation is indeed true love. Infatuation is a physical attraction as well as an emotional attraction. You get all sorts of feelings, but true love will stand the test of time. That's why you need to give it time. That's why you need to see each other in different situations, in group situations. Not just alone, but in group situations to see how they both react to friends, to family, and the like. Because many couples have fallen when it comes to this matter. In fact, it is estimated that between ninth grade and second year of college, the average person has five real loves, quote unquote, where they're convinced this is real. Now, you may not have had that many. You may have had more. But the average, 5 real loves between 9th grade and 2nd year of college. All these mixed messages inside the system. It says in the book of Judges that Samson loved a girl in the valley of Sorek named Delilah. The word for love in that particular verse is he had an affection or an attraction for. It was really an infatuation. More than infatuation, it was lust. He had a woman problem. He thought this is true love, but she was the one that caused him to stumble. It really wasn't true love at all. He was just really bouncing around from gal to gal. But there is in these verses that we read a real longing to be with each other. And notice though in verse 3, because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Name is always indicative in the scripture of character. What she is saying is that Solomon, you have such a wonderful character that a lot of people are attracted to you. Now she'll go on to say, he's really handsome too. He's cute. I'm attracted to him physically. But he has a character. Your name or your character is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. Lead me away. On and on and on. Physical desire in a romantic relationship is necessary. It's part and parcel of it. I don't want to put down physical attraction. You need it. It's not just shaking hands and saying, you know, I intellectually believe that we should be married. There should be a chemistry there. There should be an attraction, and physical love, if it's channeled right, can be wonderful. I think a young couple should be intoxicated with each other. Madly in love with each other. There should be chemistry. There should be attraction. But it needs to be channeled right, and there's more to base a future on than just physical love. There needs to be character there. And you should be concerned about the character. And so it says, beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. The wife that you marry and the husband that you marry, physically, will never stay the same. They will change so radically. Put on a few pounds, wrinkles, hair loss. And so you need to be in love with the person inside. As a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. That doesn't mean you put down physical love. I mean, when I noticed my wife, when I noticed Lenny, I thought, wow, she's good looking. I was attracted to her. There was a drawing, but I couldn't say, I'm in love. I could, but I'd be wrong. But I did say, she's cute. I was attracted to her. We met, we had conversation. We went out, I was infatuated with her. That lasted for many months until I and my indecisiveness decided to close the relationship without much communication. Didn't go over well. But we became friends for about 2 years. Then we went out to dinner, and over dinner, after a period of, she'd been away for a couple years in Youth with the Mission, she came back and she started sharing with me just what the Lord had done. And I was breathtaking. I went, wow. Because I was ministered to spiritually by her. She had grown so much in the Lord. I felt like I was hearing one of the best sermons I ever heard in my life. She was just ministering to me like crazy. There was a spiritual love and compatibility. And it was like all those things were clicking now. There was a physical attraction and emotional compatibility. And now there was a spiritual compatibility. We still waited and we thought, oh, I don't know. Could be something here. She was in Hawaii. I've told you this story a bunch of times. Let's go on. You want to hear it? I love to tell it. I could tell it all the time. Well, she was living in Hawaii in a beautiful place, which really tests your love when you have to leave Hawaii. I was living in just run-of-the-mill Huntington Beach, California. And her dad called me on the phone. Said, "Skip, this is Rod Farley." "Oh, yeah, I know you, Rod. How are you? Fine. Listen, let's just get right to the point here. I believe my daughter still has feelings for you. I don't know how deep they are or sincere they are, but she's wanting to date other people. She doesn't feel that release to do it. You need to communicate to her." And it's been 2 years. "You better call her or write to her something and tell her something one way or the other." I appreciated his boldness. He said, "I hope I'm not interfering." I said, "No, you're not." Wrote to her and the relationship was resuming. We started picking up, writing letters. And I said, "Why don't you move back to California and let's test the relationship? Nothing vague. Let's just be very honest, very vulnerable, very open about our feelings. Not commit to marriage. We don't know if we're even compatible totally. But let's test the relationship. All the way along the way, we'll express how we feel, what we think the Lord's doing, the direction God has called us in, and see if it works." Fair enough. Came back. Maybe 2 weeks after she came back, I asked her to marry me. You know, when you know, you know. And I knew. And I take a while to make a decision, but when I make one, let's go for it. Got married. 4 days later, found ourselves in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Been there ever since. She had character. Couples get a spiritual checklist. You're looking for the right person? Get a spiritual checklist, not just a physical checklist. I've told you about my friend. He used to live around these parts, who had his checklist of the wife that he wanted. I mean, when he was telling me, I just thought, give me a break. This lady doesn't exist. Well, you know, I want her blonde, and of course she has to leap tall buildings with a single bound. And I said, listen, even if this girl does exist on the planet Earth, and I kind of doubt she does, are you really sure that she's going to be greatly attracted to you? In other words, what if she has the same checklist you have? Can you fit that? I guess he was confident that he could, but get a spiritual checklist and date with a goal. Make sure that there's compatibility, not only physically, but spiritually. And this guy had character, and she saw it. And it says in verse 4, "The king has brought me into his chambers." In Hebrew, it is a request. She is longing for intimacy. She's saying, "Let the king bring me into his chambers." She's looking forward to the marriage. And then it says, "We will be glad and rejoice in you." Perhaps this is the friends of the gal. "We will remember your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you." And she says, "I am dark but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept." She feels a little self-conscious about her appearance, and it's interesting that she feels self-conscious because she has a suntan. I absolutely love that. It's a reverse today. In ancient times, the whiter you were, the better. A suntan was a picture of somebody who was a laborer, had to work out in the fields all day. If you were really beautiful, you were a city dweller, pampered in a palace, and you were white as a lily. And she was suntan. She goes, "I feel kind of embarrassed I have this tan." You know, today people pay for fake suntans. You know, they think it's the most attractive thing in the world. And she feels a little bit self-conscious about it, insecure in and among the city dwellers. And this aroused a longing to be with Solomon even more. For in verse 7, she says, "Tell me, O you whom I love, where do you feed your flocks? Where do you make it rest at noon? For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions?" Now, a veil was put over a woman either at marriage or at mourning. And I believe what she is saying is that, "Solomon, where are you? I want to be with you so much. If I can't have your companionship, I'm going to be like a person who mourns for a dead person. I have to have you. I need to be with you." And this is beautiful in verse 8. "If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold." In those verses, Solomon answers her insecurity about her physical appearance. She says, "My brothers were angry and they made me go work outside in the vineyards, but I have neglected my own vineyard," that is my own physical appearance. And he quickly comes back by affirming her and encouraging her because she feels insecure about herself. That's very important. And it's very important to the stability of a relationship that the man tells the woman, "I love you. You're gorgeous. You're beautiful." Instead of being ashamed of her, or if she feels insecure, "Honey, I feel kind of ugly." Instead of saying, "Well, you are." Because if you think that or say that, it's only a bad reflection on you guys, because you married her. And she was beautiful to you once, tell her she's beautiful. Solomon doesn't say, "Well, you know, Shulamite gal, you do have a little bit here to be desired." He quickly comes back and says, "You're gorgeous. You're beautiful." And notice, he says, "I have compared you, my love, to my filly," a horse. Now, wait a minute. Let me explain this to you. As a filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Pharaoh's chariots were pulled by stallions, not fillies. You put a filly in the midst of Pharaoh's chariot pullers, you're going to have chaos. What Solomon is saying is that his love for her is so great, she thinks she's the most beautiful woman in the world, as if she was the only woman in a world full of men. That's how beautiful she is. As if you're the only gal in an entire world filled with men sought after, just like the stallions of Pharaoh would seek after that filly. That's how beautiful you are. Lifted her up. Praised her appearance. "Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold." And now the daughters of Jerusalem, or the gals who surround the bride, are saying, "We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver." And she says, "While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me, that lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." Now the courtship is progressing. Their longing to be with each other is progressing. Their praise and encouragement for one another also progresses. And she says, she compares him to myrrh and to henna, the things that the woman would wear close to their bosom to give off a scent. But she says, in praising him back, "My beloved is to me a cluster. I was going to say clutter, and that wouldn't come off very well either. A cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." Down by the Dead Sea, which lies 1,290 feet below sea level, the lowest place in the world, is one of the hottest deserts in the world. It is barren. It brings new meaning to the word desert. It makes the moon look lush. And this place is hot and barren. In that area, the lowest place in the world, is an oasis called En-Gedi, where David fled from Saul one time. And as you walk through the canyons, you ascend a little bit, and it starts getting greener and greener and greener, and pretty soon you are in the midst of a huge set of waterfalls. Cool waterfalls. In the middle of the summer, it's cold to get in. It's an oasis. And there's these white flowers, these henna blossoms that come out that sparkle the area with their beauty. And she is giving him praise for his beauty, his physical appearance. She's saying, "All other men compared to you are a desert. You're so beautiful. You're like the henna blossoms that stand out down there at En-Gedi." And he says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes." Now, again, this is a compliment. This isn't a put down. Dove was a picture of tranquility, cleanliness, peacefulness. And to say that your eyes are like dove's eyes speak of a freshness and a beauty. And the rabbis used to say that a woman who has beautiful eyes has a beautiful character, because the ancient Jews believed that the eyes were the window to the body and really showed the character of the person. You know how body language is? Somebody acts a little bit shifty by their eyes. You think, what's going on here? Just these clean, pure eyes. And she says, "Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. You are pleasant. Also, our bed, literally our couch, is green. The beams of our houses are cedar, and our rafters are of fir. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Now, I believe that this is figurative, that she's not really speaking of the house of cedar, but figuratively speaking of where they met. This girl was from Lebanon, and you read that later on in the book, that she's Lebanese. She's from the country just north of Israel. Solomon is down in Jerusalem. And no doubt they met out in the countryside, out in a meadow. And she's recollecting the day they met. They sat and they talked together. And the place that they met, the couch, was green, the rafters of fir. She says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. He says, like a lily among thorns. See how he's praising her beauty? Not only are you a lily, but you're so beautiful, like a lily among thorns. So is my love among the daughters. And she says, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight. His fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes and raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. And again, this is a request in Hebrew. May his right hand or left hand be under my head. May his right hand embrace me. Looking forward. I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles. I guess those were pretty hefty animals to swear by. Or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. Now back in verses 3 through 6, there are three aspects of romantic love that a woman looks for in a man. I want you to notice verse 3 where she says, I sat down in the shade with great delight. That speaks of protection. It was a Hebrew idiom to speak of protection. The shade of a tree spoke of the protection of the tree. The shade of a wing of an animal, of a bird, spoke of protection. It speaks of the Lord as a bird in some places, stretching out his wings in which we take refuge, speaking of protection. Now here's a girl who works hard out in the fields in the hot sun, and she is able to enjoy the rest of his shade or his protection. He is there to protect her. I love that little old proverb that says, woman was not taken from man's head to be above him. Woman was not taken from man's feet to be walked on by him or to be lower than him. Woman was taken from man's side to be protected by him, to be close to his heart all the days of their lives. And so she speaks of the protection in speaking of the shade. And secondly, they cultivated an intimate relationship. Their relationship with each other was such that they could enjoy intimacy. For she says, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. And taste always speaks of personal experience. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Experience it for yourself. And I think what the Shulamite is getting at is that Solomon became vulnerable. Let the walls down. Let her know him, although he was royalty and a very protected kind of a person. And that he was the kind of a person that allowed for intimacy in a relationship. And finally, it speaks about in verse 4, he brought me to the banqueting house and his banner over me is love. And you know what a banner is? It's a military standard. It's something that was raised up so as the troops could go by, they could see the standard and there'd be a message on it. And what she is saying is that my fiancé is not ashamed of me. He delights in me. He's not ashamed to take me out in public. It's like a banner. His banner over me is love. It's a standard, an ensign to the people, a message that he's not ashamed, but it's a very fruitful kind of a relationship and everybody can see it. And that was shown because he brought her to the banqueting house. You might call it a restaurant. In this case, it is the public eating place at the palace. Verse 7 is a refrain where she says, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now you're going to find that phrase several times in this book. It's showing us that there is a transition taking place, a change of direction for this book, but also there's a message. When she says, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases, she is saying love cannot be forced. And we should wait patiently for it until God gives it to us. Don't try to force a relationship. Don't try to just find someone because you have to get married soon. Wait for the Lord. Now, I admit that's not easy. Waiting on God is never easy. And perhaps this will be a comfort, perhaps not. But remember, Jacob loved Rachel so much. He waited 7 years for her, was tricked by Laban, waited another 7 years for her. But it says they were as a day unto him because of the love that he had for her. 14 years of dating seemed like a day because of the love that he had for her. Yeah, love is patient. Don't force a relationship. Let God bring it to you. Say, well, I'm 30 years old and he hasn't brought me one yet. Well, you know what? Father knows best. And I would rather wait for a relationship than be saddled with the wrong one. And so she says, don't stir it up. Let it awaken. And here's her request. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle, a young stag. He's agile. He's handsome. Behold, he stands behind our wall as he's riding up now to her place, her home in Lebanon with her parents. There's a wall around the estate. He comes up riding on the horse and he's kind of looking inside to see if he can spot her. They're going out on a date now. He's riding a horse. In modern times, he'd be driving a Chevy or something. He's looking through the windows, gazing through the lattice. My beloved spoke, and he said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth her green figs, and the vines with tender grapes give a good smell. Go out and take it all in. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Now it sounds to me that he is going to Lebanon. It's the spring of the year, and they're going to go for a walk. You got to understand something about Jewish dating. They just didn't date and kind of hang around each other and see if they wanted to go on any further. There was a period of espousal that lasted 1 year before the marriage culmination, before the ceremony itself. It was called the year of betrothal. It was really an engagement. A ring was given. She wore the ring. They were legally married without any sexual relationships. They couldn't enter into the consummation of marriage. It was a period of legal dating. The only way they could be separated during that year was legal divorce, serving papers of divorce. And the only way you could get a divorce was through marital unfaithfulness, even though you weren't married at that point. It was that binding. And so during that time of courtship, it was a foundation building. They got to know one another. He's going up to her house in Lebanon. They're going to go for a walk in the country. It's springtime. Perhaps they met in the country. They're going to go for a walk in the country. American dating is an interesting thing. It serves a purpose, and yet it can be dangerous. I mean, that's how we all got married. I wasn't espoused to my wife when I was 3 years old. The parents didn't make a contract to get us hitched like in the old days. We dated. And yet in dating, especially if it's not long enough, it's just an impression that is given off. When you first go out on a date, you look your best for the guy. You get your hair done, nice perfume, the best dress, your nicest smile. And he does the same thing. It's conversation to make an impression on the person. And that's okay because you want to make a good impression. But you can't sustain a relationship on good impressions. Because sooner or later, they're going to find out the truth about you. And who you really are underneath that facade of impression. And they will have to make a decision whether they will continue with you or not based on what they find. Is the love going to last? And so it does take time in dating to build a foundation. That's why good, healthy relationships of dating, there's an infatuation, there's a winsomeness, there's a desire to be with each other, but there's an up and a down, an up and a down, and there's an adjustment that takes place where they work through problems and they realistically appraise the relationship and say, you know what? I am committed to you no matter what for the rest of our lives. I know the truth about you. You know the truth about me. I've got problems and I've got good points and so do you, but we're committed till death do us part. You want to do that? Yeah, let's get married. Now the Jews had it locked in. They were married, essentially. They were on their way to be married a year before. Now whether you pick your wife or husband or whether your parents pick them for you, just make sure that the Lord is picking them. And use the dating as a foundation building. And look at dating as a goal. I could possibly marry this person. Now, not everybody you date is going to be your spouse, I hope. Or you're going to end up like Solomon, perhaps. But every person you date is going to be somebody's spouse. Think about that. And somebody out there is dating your spouse. How do you want them to treat your future spouse? With respect, with integrity, with true love, not cheaply. So use it to build a relationship, thinking this is going to be somebody's spouse. And perhaps we're going to break up, or we both want to come out the other end drawing closer to Jesus. If not, this whole thing is just a joke. Somebody came up to me today and said, is it okay for me to pray for a girlfriend? I said, you betcha, as long as you're praying with the right motivation and with the right goal, knowing that that person could be your wife. And it's not that you're praying just to alleviate your loneliness temporarily, but that you date with a goal. You know, Lenny and I, we already pray for Nathan's wife. She probably might not even be born yet. We pray for his dating relationship already. I want to lay the foundation now and have years of prayer for Nathan so that when he meets gals, he'll have sense enough to use discernment and to distinguish, to know how to build a foundation. So they're off in the meadow taking a walk. It's springtime, but more than that, I think that this describes our relationship. You know, when you're in love, it's always spring. You could be in Siberia and think, oh, it's a beautiful day. You know, everything is seen in a new perspective, and that's how Solomon is seeing it. It's like, this is great. I see you, and the flowers are budding, and it's wonderful. And verse 14, oh, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the cliff, let me see your countenance. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your countenance is lovely. You know, doves hide in the clefts of the rocks in these little caves, and it's hard to get them out once they're there. And I think what it's speaking of is their desire to be alone together. And that's also a mark of romantic love, is the young couple wants to be alone. They want to get out of the crowd and be alone. That's okay. Just be careful. Don't get alone too much. Don't park way out in the middle of a dark alley where there's no street lights in a locked car at 2 a.m. and then wonder why you get tempted. I can't figure this out. We're always tempted. Well, gee whiz. It's good to draw closely together in romantic love, to know each other, to talk to each other, but not to a place where you become vulnerable to sexual temptation or you become involved in petting or worse. And it's also good to date in groups, as we have said. But here there's this desire. They're expressing their desire to be alone with each other. In verse 15, this is very interesting. It says in my Bible that her brothers say this. I don't think so. I think it's her, the Shulamite woman, that is saying, catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. The little foxes were little animals that had destructive tendencies. They would come into the vineyards and they would destroy those plants. They'd eat them up. It seems that there were some kind of problems in their relationship that they were working out. And she, I believe, is telling him to take the initiative in solving the problems and working through the problems to develop the relationship. For she says, catch us, the little foxes that spoil the vines. There are still little foxes that spoil an awful lot of vines today. There are wedges that come in between relationships yet today. Selfishness, pride, jealousy, inability to express true feelings to each other, pride, you won't let your guard down and really admit your faults to one another, and they still spoil the grapes. And she says, honey, we got to resolve this thing. He's saying, oh, let's just take a walk. It's wonderful. I want to be with you. I want to see you. She says, let's worry about the foxes right now. Let's talk. Let's get rid of some of these problems in the relationship. And then she says, my beloved is mine. Even though we have problems, I belong to him and I am his. He feeds his flock among the lilies. And to her beloved, she says, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of Bether. Beautiful poetic description, how she longs to be with him too. Now, in chapter 3, there's a troubled evening. It seems like she is on her bed and having a dream. And when you are about to make a hefty decision, you get a little queasy and you have dreams like this. She is scared that she's going to lose this guy. She has this dream. What's wonderful to note is that they admit their wrongs with each other and yet they work them out. She admits that she feels a little bit inadequate physically. He says, don't worry about it. You're like a filly among those horses. She gives him praise. There's problems with the little foxes spoiling the grapes, but they always seem to resolve it. Before Lenny and I were married, after I proposed to her, I did not realize how I would react to making that kind of a commitment. I mean, I tossed and I turned and I sweated in the middle of the night. I call my friends up and say, you got to give me counsel. It was funny. I asked her to marry me. She said yes. And then I jumped up from the couch and said, no, wait a minute. What do you mean, wait a minute? You asked me. Yeah, but this is a big decision. Let's talk about this. And we're weighing out, can we afford it? Is this the right time? And I was trying to be gut level honest without any sensitivity, saying, well, I don't think I love you. What? You know, what's all this talk the last several weeks? You asked me to come back from Hawaii and I'm here. You don't love me? Well, I think I love you, but I'm not sure. I don't think I can marry you. And the next day, I love you. Will you marry me? Of course, I said so. Next day, I don't know about this. It's not God's will. I mean, she thought I was the most schizophrenic thing around. I'm surprised you didn't punch me out. I'm glad you didn't, but I'm surprised you didn't. We had insecurities like crazy trying to work through this thing. But we were able to say, we do love each other. We have adequately defined what true love is in the midst of these pulling emotions. And we really know that God has called us together. We're going in the same direction. And we're going to do it. And we made a commitment. We were able to sort through our feelings and come down to the will of God in the midst of positive feelings and negative feelings. And you need that when you approach the altar. Because the minister is not going to ask you, will you have her to be your lawfully wedded wife until feelings do you part? Until someone else comes along better do you part? Until debt do you part? But it's till death do you part. And that foundation needs to be laid. And they work through that. She has this dream. By night on my bed, I sought the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him. I will rise now, I said, and go about the city. In the streets and in the squares, I will seek the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him. The watchmen who go about the city found me, to whom I said, have you seen the one I love? Scarcely I had passed them by when I found the one I love. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into the house of my mother and into the chamber of her who conceived me, the house of my mother. That's the safest place that she knew. In her dream, she couldn't find him. As soon as she finds him, she says, I'm taking you home where my mom is. That's the safest place. I know you're going to be there. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles. That's just kind of funny to me. By the gazelles, by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. And then listen to her speech. Now, in verse 6, there's a change because there was the refrain we just read in verse 5. Don't awaken love. In verse 6, through the end of the chapter, is the wedding march. She is at her house waiting for the bridegroom to come. In the ancient days, Jewish weddings were a little bit differently. You didn't have them at a church building like this. You had it at the house of the groom. And the groom would go with friends of the bridegroom and go at an unbeknownst time. They didn't have telephones, didn't have telegraphs. And so he would just show up sometime and lead the procession from her house through the streets of the city with a celebration. And they would end up at the groom's house and have a 7-day feast. The women who accompanied the bride had to be ready because many times it was at night that he would come, and so they had to have their little lamps burning brightly. Thus the parable in the Gospels where it says that the bridegroom came and they were not the virgins with the lamps. They weren't ready to go. Well, in verse 6 is this ceremony, and she looks out and says, "Who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchants' fragrant powders?" Now, Solomon had bucks, and so his wedding was the royal wedding. It was big time. It would have been telecast on every major network were it today. And he has these pillars of smoke, these incense bearers that would go before the procession with this sweet-smelling cloud of incense going before them, and she sees it. "Behold, it is Solomon's couch." It's Solomon's car. "With 60 valiant men around it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night." Ah, this is kind of neat. He comes not only with a group of guys, but with soldiers. He was the king, he could afford it. Or he was the prince, at least. But she says they have come because of the fear in the night. When you would travel from one part of Israel to another, you'd travel in a caravan. If you didn't travel in a caravan, if you traveled just a couple people or by yourself, you were always afraid of thieves and robbers. That's why Jesus said, a man went from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves. He should have gone in a caravan, should have traveled with a group of people. She says, "Solomon has taken measures to protect me from fear. I am secure in his love because he always takes precautions to assure my security, my warmth, my comfort, because of the fear in the night. Of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin, a seat. He made its pillars of silver, supports of gold, its seat of purple," speaks of royalty, "the interior paved with love." Isn't that great? "By the daughters of Jerusalem, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him." His mother, by the way, was Bathsheba. "On the day of his espousals, the day of the gladness of his heart." And he says, "Behold, you are fair, my love." And let's just read chapter 4 together. We'll close tonight. We'll pick up on it next week. But the wedding is over. We don't read about the marriage feast, but we read about the honeymoon and his description of her and his love for her. "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like the flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead." That's a compliment. She had dark, black, wavy hair, no doubt. Speaking of the Gilead area of Israel, east of the Jordan River. Beautiful, beautiful, lush area where those black-haired goats still to this day are kept in pasture. "Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep." You know, these really are compliments, but they do sound hilarious, don't they? I'm glad he didn't say, "Your teeth are like stars. They come out at night." That would be an insult. "But your..." Excuse me. "Which have come up from the washing. Each one bears twins, and none is barren among them." In other words, she has a full mouth of teeth. Not one is missing. Each has its twin, a beautiful smile. "Your lips are like a strand of scarlet. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate." Your, you know, things have changed. "Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory, which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. Come with me from Lebanon. Look from atop of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, the very heights of northern Israel. 10,000 feet above sea level, where you get that beautiful vantage point into the Hula Valley in Galilee. From the lions' dens, from the mountains of leopards. If you have been to Israel with us, you can imagine taking this beautiful gal to a vantage point coming from Lebanon back down to Jerusalem, overlooking the Golan Heights, the range of Gilead and Mount Hermon. You just get picture after picture, and you can look and see so far the beautiful rolling hills of northern Israel. They have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravaged my heart. With one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace, how fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Your lips, my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are on your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with the trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. They've had the wedding procession. They've come for the feast. The feast lasts 7 days. Even though it lasts 7 days, on the night of the wedding ceremony, they begin their honeymoon. And here's a beautiful description of the man and the woman coming together. They have refrained from knowing each other physically until this day, although they said, I long to be with you. They held until this moment. And at this moment, it becomes beautiful. And God glorifies the act of marriage. It says the bed is undefiled in the book of Hebrews. And it was for them. And he's saying, you are gorgeous. And she says, basically, I'm glad that I'm gorgeous. Come and enjoy. And so Solomon, in the book of Proverbs, in speaking of marriage, says that each man should drink water from his own cistern, his own well, and not go out and try to find satisfaction from another woman, but be committed to her forever and ever. And so we see human love, marriage love, extolled.